From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the fourth segment in a series of discussions about the intellectual and political foundations of modern conservatism, focusing on the figure of Edmund Burke, the 18th century English statesman and political theorist. The panelists are Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about theories of executive power. He's a professor of government at Harvard University. Joseph Hamburger is a political scientist at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress are political scientists at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The conversation resumes with comment about Edmund Burke's notions regarding political parties. Here is Harvey Mansfield.
One of the interesting things is that Burke was not only a partisan, but he was a founder of the very idea of party government as we practice it now.
They originated with him?
In a way it did. He wrote a pamphlet in 1770 called Thoughts on the Cause of the Present Discontents, in which he made the first argument to be found in political philosophy that party government or party is a good thing. Previously, party had always thought to be something dishonest or at best necessary in a particular situation. But Burke thought that party was a good thing regularly as an accepted and legitimate practice of free government. He thought that party loyalty, far from indicating that a person was insincere or unthinking, was, on the contrary, the best sign of consistency in politics. And consistency in politics is close enough to principle in politics. The irony is, of course, that not all the parties that have come from Burke's notion of party government would have been acceptable or pleasurable to Burke. Party government endorses the regular practice of liberal and radical parties and not only conservative parties. But the practice of working together in politics, the practice of being on the same side over a period of years with people whom you know and learn to trust, that he thought was what is valuable about parties. Nowadays, parties are, at least some parties, radical or socialist parties perhaps, are united on the basis of principle or idea or ideology rather than of common practice in politics over the years. It's more subscription to a particular idea than a relation of fellowship and authority and subordination over time.
Granted that he was opposed to doctrinarism, whether within the parties or outside, what would you say was the basis of principle for the political parties that Burke would have approved of? What role did principle have in those parties?
It was a principle of defending what you'd done in the past. There had been a difficult political problem, and you, together with your friends, had done something to solve it or to attempt to solve it. In the course of that action, you had gathered friends and opponents, and there was a certain bond that came from the experience of attempting or carrying through such a reform. And party meant more that experience of loyalty, that kind of consistency, than the consistency of a doctrinaire program. And together with that, a preference for men of property over men of talent. Men who have only talents are rather dangerous types. They don't have anything at stake in the present arrangement of things, and they want to rise rapidly to a place where they can exercise their talents. Such men must be kept in subordination to men of property who do have something at stake and are likely to be more experienced and at least sedate.
Now, why would you say that men of talents are dangerous for Burke? You do suggest that.
Well, yes, because they're not satisfied with things as they are. If they have talent and no position or no property, they want to rise, and since they want to rise, they need to have places or to rise to. Burke thought that democracy, as I said, was the most shameless form of government, and he preferred aristocracy. And aristocracy meant the rich, but the rich that he wanted were landed aristocrats. Their property was landed property, and he wanted them not because he wanted them to rule, that is, not because they were rich, but because what riches could provide for them. What riches could provide would be a larger or more comprehensive point of view, one which is not tainted by their own desire to get more for themselves. Again, what he's worried about are the men of talent who don't have riches and who have to force their way into a position where they do. That is disruptive. Those who already have riches, that is, those who inherit them, are brought up in such a way that they have an elevated and comprehensive view of society. They see why things are necessary and why things are interrelated. That makes them good at governing.
Did he assume then that they would be, hopefully, more disinterested?
Yes, of course they would be. They would have to defend their own privileges, but those privileges were for the sake of social comedy, and all society can be understood as a network of privileges. To be privileged means to have a liberty. And a society without privileges would be a society that's no longer free.
The privileges of such a class of aristocrats and landowners, does the existence of such privileges, in Burke's view, mean that others in the society are deprived, are without any rights or privileges?
Certainly not. They are deprived of those privileges, that is, the ones that the aristocrats have.
What would Burke have said they have in exchange, then?
What they have in exchange are the privileges that go with every social rank and in every social situation. A worker has the privileges of a father or of a mother. Those are not small privileges. Those are the privileges, or liberties you can call them, which make life sweet.
But one wonders, Harvey, where he got the... as we'd say it now, the evidence for his belief that the landed aristocracy really was as disinterested as he hoped. Wasn't this really more a hope on his part, or an aspiration?
I don't think it was that the landed aristocracy was disinterested, but that its interest took a particular form which was valuable to society.
Yes, but I mean, I think there was plentiful evidence, as he saw himself, that there were great dangers of abuse. And if that hadn't been the case, then in fact he wouldn't have had to spring to the defense of the Irish, American, and Indian protesters.
Absolutely right. That's why you need a free constitution. But if you try to think of some other reliance, some other group, some group of non-gentlemen to run society, then you have great difficulty and run into still greater trouble.
Harvey, which was Burke? Was he both a man of property and talents?
He's a man of talent who became a man of property.
Very modest property.
Modest property. But that was always a great problem for him, that he himself was an example of the dangerous type whose fortunes he tried to control in politics.
Well, can one say then that, can one associate for Burke the men of talent with the intelligentsia, to use a word that he would not have used?
Yes.
And so he would have been suspicious of intellectuals. for the reasons that you suggest, and that you imply that, that for Burke the intelligentsia would have been inclined to radicalism because they would like to create a political order in which there would be a place for themselves.
But he would have been suspicious of them. He also would have been suspicious of conservative intellectuals.
Why?
I think, as we've been saying right along, that the very notion of a conservative intellectual, from Burke's point of view, is a paradox. A conservatism means opposition to the intellect as such, or at least to that kind of intellect which neglects prudence.
You mean
which,
the optimism of the intellect, this unbounded sort of we can pull it off.
The extremism, the optimism of the simplicity of the intellect.
And the vanity that it has, that it can control and manage and plan. Yeah.
You're talking about pride. You're talking about
intellectual pride, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This issue of simplicity is one maybe we didn't mention, really go into very much before, but I think it's a rather important one. In regard to the French Revolution and elsewhere, the idea that some sort of simple uniform scheme can be imposed on a whole social order and remake that social order in the image of this scheme, and the simplicity and uniformity, I think, are important aspects. It's kind of related to the idea of political centralization. You need a lot of power. With that power, you can reorder society. You can reorder it in a very homogeneous, simplistic way. And of course, this is one of the most telling criticisms, I think, of totalitarian regimes. That is that the tendency of those regimes to try to atomize society, to simplify, destroy all the subgroups in society, all the autonomy that people would develop on their own and associations and so on. And I think Burke, in a strange way, already foresaw this potential in the French Revolution, this simplifying potential. Wow. But I want to go on and draw a strange parallel here. And that is that, to me, what Burke saw in society, and many conservatives like to comment on in society, its complexity, the web of human relations, the mystery of social life, the difficulty of really understanding fully the way social life works, and therefore the problem of making policy, because policy will intend certain effects and then have other effects that you didn't perhaps intend. It seems to me a real parallel here with the ecological point of view in among environmentalists, the kind of people who talk about the complexity of nature and the web of relationships in nature, in a pond, in a particular forest, and how man's intervention, man comes in with his chainsaw, his simplicities, and wants to treat this whole environment without appreciating its complexity. It seems to me there's a real parallel there between the conservative view of society and the naturalist view of, or ecologist view of the environment.
As Lou was speaking, it occurred to me that one thing that we haven't really much stressed, that we've talked around it, is an apparent dichotomy between society and politics. We've rather tended to say, well, Burke worried about action, that Burke worried about men of ideas. He worried about trying to do too much, too soon, or on too large a scale. And what we're really left with then, as you said a moment ago, when the choices for the acting politician really are as narrow as they seem to be for him, we're left with culture, we're left with tradition, we're left with law, we're left with parties, some kind of institutions. And one of the criticisms, of course, that's always been made of Marx is he didn't have a theory of politics. He didn't have a theory of the state. And I wonder if we're saying the same thing about Burke. Does he rely, in other words, on culture and on some kind of society?
Well, he certainly relies on culture and society, but he would not divorce society from politics. It seems to me that he had an understanding of the interconnection between the two that very important, and which sometimes seems not to exist today. That is, he regarded the politician, the statesman, as one whose responsibility it was to recognize the importance of the social fabric and the moral order as a foundation for a civilized politics, which include constitutional liberties and other civilizing values. And much of what he said about revolution, about the French Revolution, about Jacobins, about the American Revolution and the British government's reaction to it, I think suggests that he had a very sensitive appreciation of the interconnection between those two things. He always was urging politicians to recognize that the social moral foundations for a civilized a political order. So I would say he did not divorce the two, but that we cannot talk about his theory of one without bringing in the other.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the fourth part in a series of discussions about the intellectual and philosophical foundations of modern conservatism, with particular attention to the political theories of Edmund Burke, the 18th century English statesman and philosopher. The panelists in this portion of the conversation are Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Harvey Mansfield. Joseph Hamburger teaches political science at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz is a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Harvey Mansfield teaches in the Department of Government at Harvard University. As a scholar at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about theories of executive power.
Lou, with reference to your observation that Burke foresaw in the French Revolution the development of a kind of society that later came to be called mass society, or a society that had been atomized. Yes, I agree that he did discern in the French Revolution the threat of this kind of mass society. Indeed, he used the phrase at the time, a homogeneous mass, which was an early use of the word mass in this connection, and it was quite an ingenious observation on his part. But I wanted to suggest that there might be a connection between that and his well-known opposition to democracy, and suggest that when he complained about democracy, he was not so much complaining about what we know as democracy, but rather about this kind of mass society, which to him appeared to be a democratic society, one in which ruling groups that had prevailed before the revolution were discredited or driven into exile or guillotined and destroyed, and one in which the populace would assert its own preferences. It seems to me that perhaps when his complaints about democracy were not so much complaints about democracy as we understand it, but rather this kind of phenomenon, which even 20th century observers regard as dangerous.
Yeah, and I think the other element in it is, Joe, is Burke's fear of equality, and I think this is the thing that distinguishes his anxieties about the French Revolution, let's say, from a modern discussion of mass society. The modern discussion would accept the basic principle of equality and then worry, I think, about how you can have both equality and variety, how you can have fundamental equal rights in a society, and at the same time avoid this problem of homogenization, which I think for Burke the two went together, probably. Whereas I think a modern dilemma is to how to have the one and avoid the other.
Would you agree it's still a dilemma that is not resolved?
Yeah, I do. I was going to make a comment about also connecting Burke and not only Marx, but other radical and left-wing thinkers. I think we were talking earlier about Burke's emphasis on prudence, and another way to put this, I'd say, slightly different but related matter, I think, is the idea that politics has limits, that there are things number one, that you can't do politically, and number two, that you oughtn't to do politically, and that some of the sympathetic critics, left-wing sympathetic critics of radicalism, for example, of the Russian Revolution and other revolutions, Camus is a very good example, I think, have tried to take up this argument about limits and that the failure of revolutionary politics, one of the reasons for the failures of revolutionary politics is that revolutionaries have not wanted to recognize what these limits were. One of those limits is the nature of social life itself, what it means to tear social life apart and try to reconstruct it. This is the kind of thing that Burke already perceived in the case of the French Revolution. Now, Camus' idea of what these limits ought to be, of course, very different from Burke's idea. But I think there are connections in the sense of the a deeper recognition of the problematical aspects of radical politics and the dangers of the accumulation of power combined with intense ideological commitment that Burke saw in the French Revolution.
That's all very well, Lou, and though perhaps the best thing that radicals could learn from Burke is to forget their radicalism. Next to that, an appreciation of the limits of human action would do very well.
But let me.
But radicals are human beings, and they like to have it both ways. Like the ecologists you spoke of before, they want to keep and nature and have the chainsaws too.
Well, I think I was thinking as we were talking about Burke and the English Revolution. I was thinking of Jefferson and the American Revolution, and Jefferson's remark about the need for a revolution every 20 years, the tree of liberty being watered by the blood of martyrs, and so on. And thinking of that remark, I thought to myself, how alien this is to Burke's thinking and way of thinking, how totally out of keeping with his style of thought. And it occurred to me that what Jefferson was getting at there was not literally the need for a revolution, a bloody political revolution every 20 years, but was more the idea of political renewal. And I think that the reviving of people's political instincts, and that's related to a sense of indignation, of injustice, of commitment. I think this is the side that Burke neglects myself. I think there's a wish in his view of politics, and in generally speaking in the conservative view of politics, for political and social life to run as smoothly as possible. There's a deep wish for stability, for authority relations to remain the way more or less they've been. I mean, of course, you have to make adjustments. That's right, absolutely. Life does create these problems and we must adjust. But there is no sense that it's a good thing that we have conflict. It's a good thing that society has these upheavals. It's a good thing that the young rebel against the old. There isn't much sense in conservative thought or in Burke that these things are valuable, that we need to have them, that they're just as much a part of social life and a good part as the stability side of it.
Does this mean, Lou, that Burke is somehow fundamentally un-American? and that therefore Burke is not really available for appropriation by American conservatives? After all, American conservatism does have some relation to Jefferson. You know, some conservatives will say that they are Jeffersonian liberals. You know,
well, here,
if Burke and Jefferson are at opposite poles, does that mean then that Burke really has no meaning for American conservatives?
Well, if I could figure American conservatism out, I think I'd be able to give you an answer. But my problem is I can never exactly figure out where American conservatives stand.
What's the problem?
Several. Let me point them out. one of the problems is that American conservatives tend to identify themselves so strongly with capitalism, with the current economic arrangements in our society, with the marketplace, and with an opposition to government. And yet, there's a very strong emphasis on the magic of the economy, almost regardless of what its effects are, or in my mind, there's a great utopianism, which if they were real Burkeans, they would notice. In their attitudes about how remarkably the magic of the marketplace is going to somehow lead to the best developments for everyone, and particularly if no one interferes with it, and particularly not the government interfering with it. And this I was going to say, in the conservatism of 100 years ago, British conservatism, this is exactly what conservatives feared. They feared allowing the marketplace to run for itself. It was the British conservatives of the 1850s who interfered in the marketplace in the name of protecting women and children and limiting the hours of work and in a way defending human beings against the ravages of the free market. And that seems to me to be a very sensible conservative position. It's the conservatives, I think, who ought to want to preserve the community and the family and the right to work, the right to have a job. Well, whereas it isn't in America.
Of course, one cannot talk about American conservatism because it there's not a single conservatism, and conservatives will disagree very much with one another. And so perhaps what we ought to do is ask about particular strands or themes in American conservatism and ask whether Burke might be congenial to them. And perhaps we should consider that particular conservatism that one associates with the free market and with the hostility to government regulation. What would Burke have said about that, do you think? Would he have been sympathetic with those conservatives who were worried about the intrusions of a free market on family life, community life in the mid-19th century?
Well, my own view is that Burke would face both ways on this question. That is, he would have both identified with the conservatives who worried about the ravages of capitalism and the dangers that an unregulated market would create to society, and at the same time, later on, would turn around and worry about the problems of regulating the economy and the issues of, I suppose, of bureaucracy and of arbitrary power that arise when the government itself begins to, I wouldn't say interfere, but plan and regulate economic life. But, I mean, to be more specific, I think Burke would have found the New Deal very congenial. I think he would have regarded the New Deal and the Roosevelt reforms as very prudential politics of that day. Then you could worry afterwards about the dangers they might pose. But I would think he would have seen someone like Hoover and the total identification of the social good with a non-interfering government as a rather fanatical position, inappropriate to dealing with the realities of the time.
I don't know how he would have reacted to Hoover and the New Deal, but generally I agree with you. That is, although Burke knew Adam Smith and was sympathetic with the Adam Smith's general economic ideas, all the same, I think that he might well have agreed with those 19th century conservatives who were opposed to the intrusions of the free market because of its disrupting effect. That is, I think he might well have recognized that free market ideas, if suddenly imposed, were radical ideas that were destructive of the social fabric, and that, of course, is the one thing that he wanted to protect.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations and comments originating at the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. My guests were Harvey Mansfield of Harvard University, Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Joseph Hamburger of Yale University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.